This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast on radio and our online stream of a Main Street all across North Dakota. Race relations have been problematic in our nation since its founding. And in the 21st century, it's clear much more remains to be done. The Minot-based nonprofit Strengthen ND aims to help improve the situation with an online training series under the title Working in Indian Country. Megan Laudenschlager is Strengthen ND's executive director, and Larry Cowan wrote the book Working in Indian Country, Building Successful Business Relationships with American Indian Tribes. They spoke with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg about how non-Native people can do better.
I come from the philosophy that for most of the participants that I teach, they're non-Native, and they're federal officials, they're state, local government, corporate officials. But I've been in your shoes, and I'm merely a messenger of what I have been taught in terms of working with Indian tribes. And so that's how it all kind of comes together and how it worked. And then in 2010, I can't do these workshops forever, so I actually wrote the book, Working in Indian Country. And that book is basically all the information that's in the workshop, even the transcribed video clips that you would see in the workshops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the preface to your book, you talk about people making decisions that impact Indigenous people and Indigenous land, and there never being Indigenous people at the table. And even in this conversation, this is three people all from a non-Indigenous background. Megan, how beyond just this book, which Larry has lots of opportunity, lots of experience being a white person trying to navigate these cultural differences, but going beyond that, how do we make sure that this program isn't just what white people think other people need?
One of the beautiful parts about this workshop series and the work that Larry has done in the past is I think that it provides an opportunity for non-Indigenous people to admit that they don't know what they don't know in a space where it is okay and where it's acceptable and where they can ask questions in a way that they can gain the information to move forward. So I think where this workshop is helpful is that it's somebody who has been through a similar process that other non-Indigenous folks are hoping to go through. And it's somebody that can speak from that personal experience. So I think that's one of the pieces that we're excited about. And you know, Larry has done a lot of work down in South Dakota and has really been helpful within that space. And we're hoping that by bringing this type of workshop to North Dakota, that we'll be able to help build better relationships between non-Native and Native communities and to really help non-Native individuals understand or to recognize what it is that they don't know and help to fill some of those holes.
So when we talk about a term like build better relationships, and this is a series of Zoom meetings that will take place starting in early May and going all throughout the end of July and separated at times by different people groups as they change throughout the geographic area of North Dakota. And when you say that build better relationships, I'm wondering, is that the absolute overarching goal of this? Because oftentimes it's sort of a there's a very specific goal. You know what I mean? Like, let's boost education rates by 10%. Let's decrease violence rates by 12% or what have you. But just building better relationships. Why did you want to be so purposefully broad, Megan?
We wanted to be purposefully broad because, as you said, it applies in so many different sectors. And as we all know, maybe when we are going to, whether it be elementary or high school, or even as we move into post-secondary education, there isn't a ton of information. And unfortunately, it's not required yet in North Dakota schools to provide coursework or to provide instruction on the history of First Peoples within our state or that shared geography with our state. So if there isn't an opportunity to learn, how can people understand or engage again in a way that is comfortable or feels okay for them? So we know that whether it be with economic development, health, or education, that there's a need first to understand that not every Native nation is the same. They all have their own individual traditions or customs, and engaging with them all may look differently depending on where you're at or what type of work it is that you want to do. So I think this is kind of dipping your foot into the pool to get people engaged with Native nations so that they can develop their own experience and can learn their own individual style or tradition. So I think this is a good first step into working more equitably across North Dakota for many different types of sectors.
So, Megan, who do you anticipate or who do you hope the audience will be in terms of the demographics of the makeup?
We hope that it will be individuals who want to, it sounds a little corny, but who want to build better relationships with North Dakota, with the Native nations that share North Dakota's geography, whether that be individuals whose job requirement it is, or whether it be somebody who shares those boundaries or service areas with them. So we anticipate it to be anything from state employees or federal employees or nonprofits that provide services within the Native nations' boundaries, as well as individual business owners or businesses who would like to work more deeply with Native nations. So we anticipate it to be really a mix of folks.
Tribal people have told me many times over and over that most people start off on the wrong foot when they're trying to work with the tribe. And they don't understand things like the concept of sovereignty. They don't understand the requirements of consultation required by the federal government and the state government. And they don't understand the cultural protocols that people need to operate under when working with tribes because of the sovereignty that's involved in this whole process. And so what we're trying to do is get people to understand these culturally based protocols, like how to communicate effectively, how to build trust, how to build relationships, so they can be more effective when they make that first approach to work with tribes.
Yeah, Larry, in an earlier answer, you said that one of the questions that you like to ask in your own learning process is, what's the worst thing that I could be doing when I walk into the room? So as the person with the most experience here doing that, what did you find was just, oh, I really got off on the wrong foot there, something that really sticks in your head that you did?
That's a good question. And most people, the typical leadership model that people use is what we typically do within the government and corporate world. We make this great presentation, and we walk into a tribe and say, we have this great program for you, and here's all the reasons it's going to be great for you, and here's what you need to do and what you should do. And tribes for 200 years have been listening to what people have been telling them what to do, and they're saying, well, look where we are today. Why should we listen to you any more than anybody else? And so I think that people need to understand, when you walk in the door, you have to have a lot of humility and be humble. And one of the best things you can do when you walk in the door is start asking questions rather than telling the tribe what's good for them. And that's probably the biggest mistake people make.
I wonder, Larry, what would the role, do you think, be? And I'm thinking, for example, Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the first things that they have to do in that program is admit that they have a problem and admit that they have caused harm. And do you feel like the United States, the dominant culture, has ever done a good job admitting the past mistakes that were made in the colonization of this land?
One of the things that I've learned that I think is very important is, if you look at history for the last 200 years, there have been people with not good intentions, and there have been people with good intentions.
Hmm.
But regardless, the outcome has been negative for tribes. So whether you were trying to, you know, civil, what they called in the 1800s, you know, civilized tribes, bring them into the mainstream of the European culture that was being developed in this country, you know, that some people had good intentions and some people have very negative intentions, but the consequences were always the same. You've still got the health issues. You've got the diabetes issues because of the changes in diet. You've got the land issues, that land was taken away from tribes. You've got the treaty issues with broken treaties. So all these things that happened even 200 years ago still impact your ability to build relationships today. And one thing as tribes do is they are going to remind us in the non-Indian world of what they've gone through. They're going to repeat this history, and they're going to tell us over and over so we don't make those mistakes again, and so we don't repeat the past. And, you know, that's just, I think, an important thing people need to understand also.
Mm-hmm. How much of this will just simply revolve around the terms that we use or the way that we frame questions? There's a lot of well-meaning people who don't really realize, for example, a racist rationale for the question that they're asking.
I think you're absolutely right that a lot of people don't know what they don't know. And the workshop series is an opportunity for people to better understand the, as Larry said, past trauma or the past impacts, whether they be from well-meaning intentions or non-well-meaning intentions. Our whole goal with the workshop series, or by promoting it, and bringing Larry in to do it, is to, again, help people learn or understand that they don't know what they don't know. And now that they know better, or when they know better, we can all do better.
We provide people the opportunity in these sessions to break down stereotypes.
Hmm.
Because what we learned in schools and in books and on TV in the non-Indian world is totally different than what people in the Indian world learned through oral traditions and oral histories. And so we have to understand there's a difference in the learning mode, and the stuff that we learned reinforced a lot of stereotypes that we try and break down in this workshop. So people, you know, will say, you know, why are all these Indian people need money because they're all rich because of gaming? Well, if you really understand gaming, you know, you understand that is a myth and it's not true. And so we break down these stereotypes in this session to help people understand more thoroughly a lot of the stuff that they've learned and kind of break down the learning and then reteach them what the real world is.
Larry, you said earlier that one of the other common misconceptions is the concept of sovereignty. What did you mean by that? What don't we understand about sovereignty?
What people don't understand about sovereignty is that actually it goes back all the way to the founding of our Constitution, because the Commerce Clause of the Constitution says only Congress has the authority to regulate trade between foreign nations, states, and Indian tribes. So that put Indian tribes in the context of, you know, sovereign nations. They're independent. And people need to understand that sovereignty, that you're dealing with an independent nation, even though it is limited sovereignty, because they still can't violate the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution, because they're what we call a nation within a nation. But I think what people need to understand with sovereignty is that when you go to the table to meet with the tribe, you don't send a good friend of mine, he's Eastern Shoshone, he's a tribal chair there at one time, told me one time, he says, you know, Larry, we're not museum pieces.
Hmm.
So don't send your archaeologist to talk to us. We want to hear from your leader in your organization. And people think that, he says, the biggest thing is people don't understand us. He says, we're doctors, we're lawyers, we're all these other things, but we're treated as if we're museum pieces, and the archaeologist is the one that comes and sees us.
Hmm.
And he says, we want you to understand sovereignty, that I'm the tribal leader, and if I'm dealing with the state, I'm an equivalent level of the governor. And I want to talk to your cabinet people and your secretaries, or I want to talk about to the head of your organization, like it might be the head of the National Forest or the head of the BLM in that particular state. So don't go sending me a bunch of these other people in your organization who can't make decisions and things like that. And that's probably one of the biggest things about sovereignty that people need to understand.
How does this fit in with the overall mission of Strengthen ND?
The Working in Indian Country workshops fit in with our overall mission and vision in that we want to support self-determination within all rural communities, and that's inclusive of the tribal communities that share our geography. And as we work to support those communities, we recognize having a staff of both Indigenous as well as non-Indigenous team members that we need to, again, understand or know what it is that we don't know. So as we're continuing to try to know better and to be better, we recognize that others may want that opportunity as well. So whether it be other service providers that we work for or whether it be our staff ourselves, we know that we need to, again, work more equitably. So as we support that rural self-determination, those being both non-Native rural communities as well as rural tribal communities, we need to provide opportunities for other individuals and other organizations to engage with tribal nations that in a way that is meaningful and in a way that, again, supports better outcomes than perhaps we've seen in the past.
Megan, you've used the word equitable a few times in this conversation, and for people who don't do a lot of deep diving into social justice work, there is often a difference between treating people equally and treating people equitably. How do you differentiate between those two terms?
We differentiate it in that treating people equitably is treating people the way that they want to be treated. And I think that that's a beautiful part of the Working in Indian Country workshop series, is that you can see from Larry's experience of being a non-Native individual who had to learn maybe through some ways that might be difficult to understand, okay, this is how to understand tribal protocol. This is how to understand that so many Native nations are all very different, and that we support people to be more equitable by first helping them to understand that different people have different needs and different people need to be treated the way that they want to be treated. That's, for us, the biggest part of working equitably across North Dakota, in that providing people equal opportunity doesn't mean that everybody truly has that equal opportunity. People need to have differentiated supports, regardless of where they live or what their background is. And in order to provide those equitable or differentiated supports, you first need to know and understand just truly the different nuances of the different people that we have living here in North Dakota.
The Zoom sessions, it is $200 per person. Megan, are there some scholarship opportunities, for example, a small nonprofit that could be a little bit of a burden for their staff?
Yes, absolutely. For individuals or organizations to access scholarship opportunities, all they have to do is either give me a call at 701-303-0840 or reach out to me via email at megan@strengthennd.com, and we can definitely support them in whatever need that might be. And we are truly hopeful that folks will engage in this opportunity and want to learn more about the beautiful Native nations that we have sharing our geography.
Larry, with a term like Indian country, you could make a pretty strong argument that should be all the land in this area. What do you mean when you say a term like that?
Well, Indian country can have many definitions, and typically what in the contemporary society we live in today, most people define Indian country as within the exterior boundaries of an Indian reservation. And what people don't understand is not every tribe in this country, even federally recognized right. tribe, has our land-based tribes.
There are nearly 600 federally recognized tribes.
There's a little over 570,
yeah.
correct. And so Indian country, the way I define it in these workshops, is Indian country makes up, you can combine it. It includes the reservation. It includes the traditional ceded lands that the tribes used to occupy, and they still have the rights to hunt and fish and gather in many cases. Indian country, but most importantly, to me, Indian country includes the people. And it's the people that we want to focus on in the building the trust and basically rebuilding trust, building the relationships. And so when you work in Indian country, it doesn't matter whether you're on a reservation or not and the programs that you're working with, because, you know, social programs go beyond the reservation boundaries. Health programs go beyond the reservation boundaries and all these things. So we're dealing with the people, and that's what we're concerned about, is teaching the non-Indian people in our communities about, like Megan said, what are the cultural protocols, the way they want to be treated, so we can start off on the right foot and provide the respect and everything that we need to be effective in working in Indian country. And then we follow up the sessions. I think it's very important too, is we have a panel, a discussion with tribal leaders and a panel discussion from the reservations. And so the last Zoom session will include that panel discussion. So students can take questions of what they've learned about in all the other modules and pose questions to these tribal leaders and get the local perspectives. Because you got to remember, as you said, Ashley, there's 570-some federally recognized tribes, and each one is a cultural microcosm in this country. I can't learn the cultural protocols of every tribe. Yeah. So at the end of the session, we try and bring in the local people so they can share their local perspectives and their local culture and their local protocols that they believe is important.
You have been doing this work for decades. Is there one point that really just seems to be, no matter how much effort and work that you put into it, that really just remains a sticking point that the people that you work with just can't get past?
Yes, and it's follow-through.
Oh.
It's follow-through, and tribes tell me over and over that an organization will come to them and they'll make a commitment. Well, we want to really start working with you, and we want to start doing these things together and all that, and we're going to meet with you once a month or something, and then they quit doing it. Mm. And that's the biggest downfall that organizations have, is they don't keep their commitments to continue working with the tribe and building relationships. And the other thing I think is important that people understand is many tribal people tell me that I have to know you before I can do business with you. Yeah. So building the social relationships is kind of paramount into building the trust. And so it's not something that's done overnight, and people have to have realistic expectations that this is going to take a while, because it took a long time to erode the trust. Now it's going to take a long time to build it back up.
Yeah.
So those are just things people need to understand.
Megan, hearing that follow through is the weakest link. What's Strengthen North Dakota's approach after the Zoom meetings are over?
Our approach after the Zoom meetings are over are to continue our work with Stacey LeCompte, who serves as our Indigenous Communications and Tribal Advocate, as she continues that economic development supports not only for tribal governments, but also for Native-led organizations and Native business owners. We have committed to working all across North Dakota in the best way that we can. And with that, we know and understand our own limitations. And that's a big part of what Stacey on our team is able to do, is to have that long-term follow through with North Dakota's Native Nations, serving exclusively North Dakota's Native Nations, so that we can carry forward the work that we're trying to do long into the future and try to carry that forward in the very best way that we can.
Megan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Larry, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much yourself. Appreciate it.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg with Strengthen ND Executive Director Megan Laudenschlager and Larry Cowan, author of Working in Indian Country, Building Successful Business Relationships with American Indian Tribes. The first workshop starts in May and will be offered Tuesdays and Thursdays at 11 a.m. Central. The registration deadline is April 23rd, and you can find out more at strengthenND.com. Coming up on Main Street, News Director Dave Thompson recaps the week's headlines, and Matt Olin reviews Hillbilly Elegy. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. February oil production dropped beyond what state officials had predicted. Daily oil production dropped to 1.083 million barrels a day. State Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helm says he anticipated a 2-3% drop, but he says the February drop was 6%. He says you can trace that to the week of February 14th, a period of extreme cold, especially in the southern U.S.
The Southwest Power Pool had power problems that rolled all the way up into WAPA, and WAPA had a series of rolling blackouts for 2 days, and those impacted Williams, McKenzie, and Divide County.
Helm says natural gas plants had periodic shutdowns. He says gas gathering infrastructure was down 20% for a few weeks, and some oil wells stopped pumping. Helm says the operators received very little warning.
They just got calls from Montrell Williams and from McKenzie Electric saying that they were ordered to do load shedding, and that if they couldn't do load shedding, they were going to have to force rolling blackouts.
But Helm says there was better news on oil prices. He says the February price was 4% above the forecast, and he says that's making up for any lost barrels. A bill that would require grade school and high school student athletes to compete in sports according to their birth gender is on its way to Governor Burgum for his signature. Jana Farley is communications director for the ACLU of North Dakota. She says North Dakota is joining a number of other states pursuing such legislation, which is likely to end up in the courts.
It sure could be. I mean, this kind of discriminatory legislation has that written all over it. You know, a House bill 1298 violates the United States Constitution and Title IX of the Civil Rights Act, which protects all students, including those who are transgender, from discrimination based on sex.
Farley says this kind of bill creates a solution for a problem that does not exist. She says proponents claim the bill is for the safety of students, but it turns out it's not for the safety of all students.
And in doing so, it's harming some of the most vulnerable people in our state. Transgender students, even if they are not interested in participating in sports, they are hearing our elected officials talk about them in a discriminatory way, as if transgender kids, they don't have the rights to be happy and healthy like all students.
Similar legislation enacted by lawmakers in Idaho was blocked by a federal court last year. She says the same could happen with North Dakota's law, all at the expense of taxpayers in the state. And as construction continues on the massive $100 million Amazon Fulfillment Center in North Fargo, another part of Amazon Network is setting up in West Fargo. It's an Amazon hub referred to as a last-mile delivery station. Packages arrive at stations like this from fulfillment centers and loaded onto vehicles for speedy deliveries to area customers. West Fargo Mayor Bernie Dardis says it's a great addition to the fast-growing city, adding more than 100 jobs.
When the first rumblings, if you will, or the first thoughts that Amazon was coming into north of the airport there, we did a little research, and it was soon thereafter when they finally did name it that we were aware that they would be looking for space for the hub and that we were under consideration.
The leased building is more than 63,000 square feet. A recent report indicated Amazon is now operating more than 250 last-mile delivery stations nationwide. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hark, Dave, news director for Prairie Public. Is that the wire machine in the background? I wonder what news of the day is spilling out of that. And we check in with our news director every Friday to get a review of the week's big stories. And, of course, the legislature is in session, so that's one of them.
It is, yes.
And the COVID vaccinations is another. 45%, almost half the states got one shot.
Right, and I'm proud to say that I've got my two now. And
me too.
And that's very good. And that's very good. But, you know, 45%, and they're actually now saying that there's been a little bit of a slackening in people seeking the COVID shot. So there's going to be a new effort by the state health department starting next week to try to ramp that up again, because they really want to get as many people vaccinated as soon as possible.
Well, as an old guy who remembers the polio epidemic back in the 50s, mm-hmm. and the concern about getting everybody, especially kids, vaccinated at that time, this blows that out of the water.
It does.
This is amazing. The number of vaccinations that are being given in this country, in this state, worldwide, it's just amazing.
It is. But it shows you how serious a threat that they say COVID-19 is. It was something new. It's a SARS variant. And we're seeing all sorts of variants now, too, by the way. And at least the preliminary results show that these vaccines are doing very well against at least most of the variants.
Well, there is a suggestion out there that we will ultimately need booster shots, just like we do for flu and things like that.
Right, and you've heard the one report that I read this morning is that one of the firms is going to develop a combination flu and COVID shot.
Yippee.
Which I thought was very interesting.
A one-stop vaccination.
Yes.
Very good. Well, this very controversial transgender sports bill has passed the legislature. It's heading to the governor. Are we going to have sort of a Friday quiet afternoon veto or not? Or is he going to sign the bill? What's going to happen?
Well, that's a very good question because, and this is based on stuff that happened in the 1919-1920 range. Governors are not supposed to threaten a veto.
Yeah.
But he's holding his cards very close to his chest. And he said today the bill has not gotten to him yet. There's a procedure that you have to sign the bill in both chambers, and then it has to go through a finalization through legislative council, then it gets to the desk, and then the governor will decide whether or not to veto it or he's going to sign it.
Sounds like it's being slow-walked through the Capitol.
Not the only one, though. Not the only one, because the mask mandate bill is also being a little bit slow-walked to the Capitol as well.
I saw that, and again, both of these were, you know, significantly approved by the legislature. But the transgender one, to me, is a little confusing. It will require that that these students in grade and high school compete with their birth-assigned gender, but that will also study it. Is that the idea here?
Right. And apparently the study is going to be, A, how big an issue is this, and B, what would the effects be, you know, in putting in this new mandate?
But in the meantime, that mandate will be in effect?
That's correct.
Wow. Okay. Well, stay tuned.
Now, remember, there's an old legislative saw that says you convert things to a study because that's where bad bills go to rest. And I'm not saying that, you know, you can make up your mind whether this is a bad bill or a good bill, but there were enough people in one of the chambers who thought that they should at least try to study it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there may be some blowback here.
There might be.
The Senate has okayed a merger of the Health Department with Human Services, but by one vote, Dave, you reported this earlier today.
24 to 23. That is amazing. That vote was really closer than I thought, but I had heard some rumblings in the Senate that there was some pushback on that bill, too. And, you know, the Health Department is quite a bit smaller than Human Services. Human Services has 2,000-plus people. Health Department has about 200 people. But there's a perception problem. They say out there, are we combining to make a super agency? So there's a bit of pushback on that, too.
Well, this is an interesting development as well. You reported earlier this week that the Senate has proposed $3 million for a consultant to basically look at a new state hospital at Jamestown.
Right. And if you remember back to the beginning of the session, Governor Burgum had proposed that Jamestown have a new state hospital. And the state hospital is really pushing it because a lot of those buildings are very old and they were designed for when you had a number of inpatient people there. Now you can have a smaller footprint hospital, maybe 75 to 100 patients. Because a lot of things are being done now in community-based settings, which everybody says is the way to go for treating, you know, addictions, treating mental illness situations. Now, they said they do want a consultant because they just don't want to throw money at something and say, okay, build it. They want to have somebody with a professional look at it to say, what does the state need?
Well, the superintendent of the state hospital told us earlier this week that the hospital actually predates statehood for North Dakota. So there's some old facilities there, and that a newer facility might actually improve outcomes. So
right, and I happen to love the quote from Senator Dever from Bismarck: "The old hospital is old."
Which is an understatement.
Understatement is right.
Well, in the corrections budget bill, Dave, you've reported that New England would lose inmates.
Yes, you've seen that that has been an issue for at least a couple of biennium right now. The concern is that New England is far away from treatment facilities, that if you move some of the inmates out of New England into, say, the Youth Correctional Center in Mandan, which is the proposal right now, that they'll get closer to treatment. And also there's concern that in New England, a lot of these people are coming from eastern and central North Dakota. They're far away from families. And they say families are what gives these inmates more, shall we say, impetus to go seek treatment and to go get the treatment and to recover.
Okay. Let's move on to another somewhat controversial subject. You reported on the 15th of this week, just yesterday, that the Senate has approved a tax holiday for lignite-fired power plants.
Right, and this is about a $21 million bill per year, and it's a five-year tax holiday. And they're saying that this will help, you know, keep lignite coal competitive when you go into these power markets like the Southwest Power Pool or the Midwest Independent System Operators, where they aggregate electricity and then, you know, parcel it out. And they find the least expensive alternative for its member co-ops and member investor-owned utilities. But they're saying if we can lower the price of coal-generated electricity by giving a tax holiday, it will remain competitive and save those coal jobs and those power plant jobs in Western North Dakota.
But, of course, it's tied to the somewhat problematic idea that coal-fired power plants will be in our future.
That's right. And I know there is a real move in this legislative session to try to save the coal industry that way, that I have heard figures, and I was looking at it the other day, that if you add up all the incentives to keep coal viable, it's almost $500 million.
Well, and let's not call that a subsidy. Okay. Let's be careful with our terminology.
Right.
Okay. How about upgrading rural internet? Everybody wants that.
Yes, and this is an interesting program. It's through the FCC, and it requires that if you're going to get some money on this, if you're a rural co-op with a lot of customers, you know, that are few and far between and don't have access to really robust broadband internet, that you have to at least give it a 1 gigabit footprint. You have to build out to 1 gigabit. And I know that there's a number of co-ops who want to take advantage of this because they do want to, you know, give a better internet footprint to people. It's modern world. It's modern technology. We need more and more robust wideband internet in North Dakota.
Yeah, especially since people are working out of their homes because they can these days. That's been proven by the pandemic, among other things.
Or they take classes online.
Yeah, too, so. And you need broadband. You need to have a good internet connection. This is an interesting idea. Dave, you reported on Wednesday that there's a group that wants to limit initiated constitutional measures to a single subject and require a 60% vote.
Right. Now, this comes from a couple of measures on the last 4 to 6 years that have passed, and one in particular where there were multiple subjects. What they want to do is limit it to one topic, and then they want to put a 60% plus one requirement on it, because right now it's 50% plus one. And if you wanted to amend the U.S. Constitution, the bar is quite a bit higher than that. So they thought going to 60% plus one is where it should be if you're going to change the Constitution. The people who support the bill say that they don't want the Constitution messed up with things that could be statutory language.
Okay, like a marijuana proposal that's likely to be out there pretty soon.
That's correct. Now, here's my delicious irony on this, and I'm only pointing this out because it doesn't talk to the merits of the bill, but this group that's circulating this petition can get it on the ballot, and they can pass it with 50 plus 1% of the vote.
There's the irony of that. Yes.
There's a little irony of that.
Okay. Who's your legislative review guest this evening?
State Representative Michael Howell of West Fargo. He's a member of House Appropriations. We talk about things like what's happening with the COVID Act money and what are the big things, what are the bonding issue look like right now, and maybe even redistricting a little bit.
And when can people hear it?
6:30 p.m. Central Time on our radio service. Anytime, of course, on our digital platforms.
All right. Always a pleasure to check in with News Director Dave Thompson.
Thank you, Doug.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean, and this week, Matt, we're going to talk about a movie we've both seen, Hillbilly Elegy.
Wow, hard to get this one out of your brain after seeing it, and not in a good way, Doug. This is, I think, a pretty tone-deaf, misfire, disastrous film. So Ron Howard directs J.D. Vance's memoir, which was a book, of course, about his time growing up in Ohio and Kentucky, in, you know, hardscrabble poverty. The family's originally from Kentucky. They moved to Middletown, Ohio. And the book was very, very different from the movie. And I'll get to that in a bit, Doug. But this is one of these Oscar bait type movies that I'm sure in a pitch meeting looks like, oh boy, you know, big stars, big director, big stars under heavy makeup. This has Oscars written all over it. But the problem, Doug, is the film is so clean and so sanitized in Ron Howard's hands that you don't quite get the sense that things are that bad. You know, I mean, clearly growing up for J.D. Vance with, you know, a drug-addicted, opioid-addicted mother played by Amy Adams, I'll get to her performance in a minute, was not good. The amazing thing is he got out of there. He went to Yale and graduated from law school and writes this memoir about growing up there. But in Ron Howard's kind of practiced Hollywood hands, the film almost comes off, Doug, like a bathed in sunshine Lifetime movie. Even when things are bad in the movie, they almost come off laughable. Nothing worse, Doug, in a movie than something that comes off unintentionally laughable. And that's what happens in a few spots. I would liken Ron Howard directing this movie to a bad marriage of a director to source material. It just doesn't work. I mean, I always think of Robert Altman directing Popeye, which is probably the worst example of a director to source material that just does not work. You remember that movie, Doug? It's just Robert Altman should not have been directing Popeye. So it's not a good film. It's flashbacks within flashbacks. The flashbacks have that kind of pretentious slow motion thing going for them. The plot is basically Vance is at Yale and gets called back home because Amy Adams has OD'd. And his sister, played by Haley Bennett, is trying to deal with it. And we get flashbacks to his youth growing up and then back to him driving back to Ohio to try to deal with things all the while he's trying to interview with law firms. So he's got a lot going on. I will say the performance of Gabriel Basso as the grown-up J.D. Vance, I didn't like that either. He's not a terribly expressive actor. But let's talk about Glenn Close and Amy Adams. So Glenn Close has been nominated for an Oscar and a Razzie for the same performance. That tells you how different people are viewing her performance as Maymaw, you know, the grandmother of the whole thing. And if you look at the home movies, which they run at the end of the movie, she looks exactly like the grandma. They have her made up correctly and perfectly, and she really does give her all in this performance, but the film is so bad. The real problem, I think, lies with Amy Adams. Amy Adams, to me, is badly miscast as J.D. Vance's mother. She's opioid addicted, heroin addicted, but Amy Adams looks like Amy Adams. So as the mom, she never looks like a drug addict to me. She looks like Amy Adams. And even in the scenes when she is violent toward the kids and bad, Amy Adams doesn't convey danger on the screen, Doug. She's not that kind of actress. We think of Enchanted and some of the movies she's done. I would have gone with a different actress here, but I'm not sure any actress could have saved this film because the screenplay is too sanitized. And Howard also does not get into some of the touchy subjects of the novel. You know, Vance kind of goes down a social and political rabbit hole talking about why white, rural, poor Americans vote Republican. He gets into that in the book, and that is never touched on in this movie. He also kind of has this somewhat controversial theory about why the poor stay poor. And so some of the stuff in the novel really had some blowback from some circles because they didn't buy what he was saying. And, you know, he got out of Appalachia and now he's looking back with sort of this everybody can get out if they pull themselves up by their bootstraps. So Howard does not go down that rabbit hole. That would have been a very controversial way to make the movie, and he avoids that completely. So not a good film. In fact, a really bad film, considering kind of the Oscar chances this film was given when it went into production.
Well, I was expecting more as well. And, of course, I'd seen J.D. Vance on all these talk shows talking mm-hmm. about that theory that you referred to. He co-wrote the screenplay with Vanessa Taylor, so he certainly knew what was going on the screen. For me, I didn't look at the movie so much as sanitized or, you know, or for me, it was like one note. It was dysfunction and a downer for the whole movie. Yes, it's uplifting that he gets to go to Yale, but my goodness, there aren't many light moments in this film. And yes, the performances are somewhat problematic. I wasn't as taken with Glenn Close as other people were.
Oh, I wasn't either. No.
I just thought it was a bit of a, you know, sort of a serious Grandma Clampett kind of thing. And I was expecting more, and I was disappointed. That's the bottom line for me.
Yeah, Glenn chose the scenery, and certainly Maymaw, the who she's based on, was probably a lively character. And certainly her character is important to this movie, and I'm not going to tell people why it is, and her relationship to her grandson. And that's really a relationship that's really the basis of the film. I just think Amy Adams is the big problem. I don't see her in this part. Not that it's all on her shoulders, the fault of this movie. Like you said, Doug, Vance was in on the screenplay. So clearly they have set aside the political and social ramifications of this movie for kind of a looking back somewhat wistfully and somewhat woefully to his childhood. Yeah. So, I mean, there are some downer moments in the movie, but they try in the end to make it uplifting, and they try to turn it into this kind of lifetime, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps type movie. The whole thing just doesn't work. I would call it a misfire. You know, the tone is off on the film. It's almost like you're watching a series of vignettes, Doug. There's really no character development for the actors to really chew on. You get a scene here, and there's a scene here where he's knocking over stuff in a grocery store, and let's go to another scene where Amy Adams is abusing the boy, and it's just kind of pell-mell all over the place. No real cohesion here.
Okay, so it's not our favorite movie.
No.
Okay. So Hillbilly Elegy is the movie. It's got this, powerhouse director, powerhouse cast. I was intrigued to see that Glenn Close, with this nomination, has now been nominated for 8 Academy Awards, has yet to win one, apparently.
She's going to be 0 for 8 in about a week and a half.
And Amy Adams has been nominated for 6 yes. Academy Awards. Somebody's won one. Who is it?
That's Ron Howard for Beautiful Mind 2001. Yeah, Glenn and Amy are great actresses. I'm not saying they aren't, but they're 0 for 14 now. Collectively, but you got to be good to be nominated. This just should not have been a nomination for Glenn Close. She should have won years ago for Fatal Attraction. I've said that for 33 years, that the Oscars screwed up when she did not win for that movie.
All right. Well, we've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 16th. Thomas Rogers was born on June 4th, 1890, to a prominent Arikara family on the Fort Berthold Reservation. When the U.S. declared war on Germany in 1917, American Indians volunteered to serve in large numbers. Like many of these sons and grandsons of warriors from earlier times, Thomas Rogers was raised with the elders' stories of the warrior tradition. On April 1, 1917, Thomas traveled to Bismarck to enlist. On New Year's Day, 1918, he arrived in France and served with Company A of the 18th Infantry. Rogers was assigned to the intelligence section and served as a battalion runner and sniper. During the night, Rogers' job was to scout the front lines, to determine enemy positions, and to capture German sentries. If the enemy refused to surrender, Rogers killed him and brought back his uniform jacket. During these silent night raids, Thomas carried no weapons and used only his hands to deal with the enemy. On 30 straight nights, Rogers killed or took prisoner 33 German soldiers. Rogers was cited for bravery in capturing many enemy sentinels that, when questioned, provided valuable intelligence. During the day, Rogers proved himself as a sniper. An excellent marksman, he scanned the enemy lines and dispatched dozens of the enemy. In recognition of his prowess as a night raider and sniper, he acquired the nickname that was known by friend and foe alike, the Spectre. Rogers was promoted to sergeant and recognized as a man of great courage, initiative, and intelligence, a soldier of the highest quality who volunteered for the most dangerous missions. After the war, Rogers came home to North Dakota and married Lucy Coffey. In recognition of his solitary night raids, Arikara elders gave Thomas the name Charges Alone. In 1926, Rogers received a presidential citation from Calvin Coolidge for valor and very extraordinary meritorious service in the defense of our country. Although much renowned for his service in France, Rogers was a quiet man and would not talk about the war. He was humble and unassuming, qualities much admired in a warrior. This is the anniversary of Rogers' last full day on Earth. The next day, April 17, 1965, Thomas died in a car accident at the age of 74. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Nelson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Peter Sagal. Nobody can afford to buy a home right now, so listen to this week's news quiz in your hobo encampment. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Monday on our show, the television documentary American Oz airs that evening on PBS. It explores the life of author L. Frank Baum, including the time he spent in Dakota Territory. On our Monday show, Ashley Thornburg will visit with filmmaker Randall McLaurie. And Midwest Murder is a podcast that dives into the Midwest's most famous murder cases. The show is going on tour with stops across North Dakota, and Ashley will talk about it with host Jonah Lanto and researcher Seanann Tangney. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.